Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Joining me today is Juliana. Say hello.
Hello, everyone.
And we are not recording in person today. I am in Lima in Peru and Juliana is in Berlin in Germany. So we are recording this via Skype. So sorry about any reduction in audio quality. And we also can't see each other. So we can't just like prod each other if we want to talk. So hopefully we both get our say. Anyway, today's book, do you want to talk about this? Why are we reading this one?
Well, certainly because it's a book that we both read before, but you haven't done a review on the podcast yet, have you?
No, I've not reviewed this. It's Isaac Asimov's Caves of Steel. And I think I've reviewed a few other books by Isaac Asimov, but not this one. And it is one of my favorite Isaac Asimov books, I think.
Exactly. And so why not give it a little review on the podcast?
Yeah. So we read this one just as an ebook. And again, this time I was like, OK, you finish reading it and then tell me and then I'll finish reading it and we'll do the review. Because otherwise I often finish reading things a lot quicker just because I have more time or I listen to an audiobook version. But in this case, yeah, you did finish it and I finished this up last night. So it's pretty clear in my head. So, yeah, Caves of Steel is a novel by the American writer Isaac Asimov. It is essentially a detective story and illustrates an idea Asimov advocated, that science fiction can be applied to any literary genre rather than just a limited genre, which is the first line on Wikipedia.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And this is certainly adds to why I enjoyed this book so much.
Yeah.
Because it does combine two of my favorite book topics.
Yeah, I think the reason why I recommended this to you when I think it must have been when we first started dating and you were like, oh, what science fiction books would you recommend? And you had read a few in the past, and I was like, okay, let's try Caves of Steel and these and others in the series because you were more into reading this crime fiction and detective fiction.
Yes. So that was actually, I got this originally when we got together as a paper book, and it had three of those robot stories within one book. It was like a compilation. And I read it in German first. And this time I read it in English.
In the original English, yes.
Yes. Which was fun.
Yeah. So this is part of his robot series. It is a publication date, June 1954. And the thing that I like about the robot series, I can't remember which podcast I heard this on, or was it a lecture or something, and it's the idea being that lots of stories will have a modern setup. They have their own internal rules that they follow and things, and there's a very easy shortcut to get into those rules or what kind of story that you have. So if a story starts, once upon a time, you'll straight away know that it is a fairy tale. And all of the rules that come along with that, it just starts up, you know.
I think you accept other rules easier.
Yes,
if you already know.
But then there's also like, you know, histories and stuff sort of like in the time of this, you know, and you go, right, okay, so now we're going to get some epic story, you know, in the age of, and also with Star Wars, you know, like a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, you just hear that and you're like, oh, right, I know what we're into here. I know what rule set we have in Star Trek. In Star Trek, it is sort of like, you know, going where no one man has gone before. No, is it? This is the log of the.
Also, you know that you're on a science expedition ship. This is generally how it is. So you know people who want to find new places, new.
Yeah. But it just always starts off like captain's log, whatever. And you just hear that and you're like, oh, right, okay, I know rule set now. I think I heard that in relation to, I think, the Isaac Asimov robot stories, where it always starts off by saying, you know, like, these are the three laws of robotics. And as soon as you read those at the start of a story or see them in the, you know, at the start of a story, you're like, okay, I know kind of what kind of story that I'm getting into here. And that's the case is this. I'm not sure. I can't remember if it actually starts off like listing those three laws of robotics, but a lot of the short stories do about the about these robot stories.
I think this one doesn't have them, but it it mentions them early on.
Yes, it mentions them. But I'm just saying, as soon as you know that this is a story of robots with positronic brains and that obey the three laws of robotics, you know what kind of story it's going to be. And pretty much every single one of these stories, these robot stories, or at least the early ones, is like Isaac Asimov putting down, like, what would it take for them to be a society with robots living alongside men, and what would we need to do to have people be happy about that? And that is, of course, he's like, okay, let's bring in these three laws of robotics, which he developed over a time with some, you know, over some short stories writing. But of course, every single one of these readings, every one of these ideas is, okay, it doesn't matter if we put these in place. Humans are still not going to be comfortable around robots because, you know, they'll play out in this way, or it'll play that way, or play out in this way. And this book really kind of wraps up so many of those ideas of, like, okay, it doesn't matter how good the robots are or how safe they are. Here's a reason why in the future people will not want to be
around them.
Yeah, around, like, robots, yes, or whatever. So,
because you mentioned the laws of robotics, I marked the first time it was actually mentioned in the book.
Okay.
Because for me, it starts off way more like a detective story. At the beginning, we're just together with police guy.
Yeah.
And on my pages here on the ebook, it was on page 171 that it was first mentioned.
How many pages though? Like, what percentage of that through the book is?
Wait a second. This book has 271.
Okay.
No, 269 pages for me.
Yeah, so it's a big chunk of the way into the book where it's there. But, you know, of course, people going into this know it's a robot, you know, it's like an iRobot kind of story, I guess.
Of course.
Because as soon as you're introduced to Daniil Olivier, the readers would know that if anyone had read any of these other stories, robot stories, they'd have got that.
But there's the other robot that you get introduced first.
What's that?
Which is quite nice.
Sammy.
Sammy. And this is kind of like the first real encounter with a robot working for humans, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, in this book. But the whole point is that there are only two robots in the whole story, unlike some other Asimov books. So the setup is, put it this way. When I was reading this book, I've read this book twice before, three times before, so none of this story was any surprise to me, and I knew what happened, and so I was kind of like coming at it from a different direction in this reading, because I, like I say, I already know what's happening, so I can kind of see the story, like, developments as they come along, and it's quite fun to read a detective novel when you know who done it, you know, just to, and then you can kind of see more of the craft of the writing, you know, because it's not playing tricks on you, it's all just laid bare.
Sure.
But one thing I noticed a lot more about reading it this time is that it's very much a dystopian novel. It's very much like taking the ideas from 1984, like with, you know, the different levels of society, even to the point where, in your room is a television, which is, you know, you can't watch it all the time, but it's going to be on these times, or you can watch it these times. In fact, you don't have a choice to watch it or not at these times. You are going to watch the TV at this time.
You're classified in these different caste system things. You know, the C categories and stuff.
Yeah.
So it depends very much on how your standard in society is.
Yeah.
Much benefit of anything you get.
Yeah, and if you get declassified, that's really bad, because then you're not like any, you don't have any human rights anymore.
Yeah.
And as you work your way up the levels, you can eat food in private, or you can take a shower, or you have running water in your room, you know. And I'd forgotten, I mean, that was the thing that really stood out to me, that I'd forgotten how much this book is like, we are in it. A world with, what is it, 8 billion people or something like that, as though that is a high number of people. We're like, are we to like 7 billion or something? Six, 7 billion at the moment.
But I guess in 1954, that was an unbelievable high number of people.
Yeah, of course. There was probably only about 2 billion people or whatever at that time.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe it even has it.
In steel caves, which is quite nice.
And everyone lives in these underground, what does it say here? I'm sure it must say.
Isn't that the domes?
Well, yeah, everyone lives under domes. And this is one of those things that I always find weird in these science fiction novels, where there's the story relies on a social, what would you want to call it? Like, in this case, it's like nobody's allowed to go outside. And in other books, it's sort of like everyone wears gloves all the time. And it's like, oh, no, you would never have anyone without gloves. And yeah. I always find that funny that there's these rules and the rules are held up as something that, oh, no Earthman would ever walk outside. Everyone, you'd get claustrophobic. Yeah. They stay under the domes. And it's fun. It's fun that that's what the story relies on.
Yeah, it's also interesting to see how easy societies can accept rules as just normal behavior, because they literally say in this book, there is no literal law to leave the dome, or like you can physically just do it. There's no, there are no gates or anything. You can just leave it. But humans just accept a certain behavior as a rule that nobody would ever even think of breaking.
Yeah.
And that is interesting, because I often challenge myself in questioning normal social behavior and asking me, why am I doing this?
Yeah. Which is, what rules am I following now that I don't know that I'm following, that I don't even realize? However, I do think it is, like I say, it's fun to read that kind of stuff, but I always find it is a bit of a failing when it's just accepted that literally no Earthman would ever do that. And at the end of the book, no Earthman has done it, has gone outside. Yeah. Whereas I think
it's quite convenient.
Yeah, it's very convenient. And that's always that thing, like, you know, in these, what were the books we were reading where, like, oh, everyone has to have gloves on? I can't remember what the books were, but we were talking, I was thinking about that recent book.
Han Yu Li.
Yeah. But there's, you know, there's all this kind of stuff, and it's sort of like, oh, you're not allowed to use your left hand, or you always have to have a glove on your left hand, or you're not allowed to do this, and nobody would ever think about this.
Certainly in the Anne Leckie books.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, some Anne Leckie books. It's like, oh, no, nobody would ever do this, you know, or no human, oh, but these aliens would, oh, whatever. And I always find it a bit weird, because in every rule like that, I think it just sets up a taboo, and there would be, like, a whole, like, cult of people, or maybe not a cult, but a whole, like, type of personality, which would get a thrill out of that. It's sort of like, yeah, of course we're not allowed outside, but of course people go outside, like, because 2% of the population goes outside because they're the weird ones who get a thrill out of doing so.
And it's
weird that these books never really think about, that's like going against those unspoken rules is a kink.
And everyone follows those rules.
Yeah, if there is a rule that everybody follows, 1% of the population will find it stimulating to do the opposite. So everyone lives in these, you know, the caves of steel are these domes, all these cities have got domes over them, but they're not just cities with domes, it's sort of like it's just completely built up. There is no outside. There isn't even... it's difficult. I find it difficult to picture how many levels there are to this New York.
It feels very much like a city that we know.
Yeah.
And just, I don't know. I also don't really understand. I have some problems understanding what the space town thing is.
Yeah, like, why is it different?
Where,
like,
is it? Is it up in the air or is it on the ground?
It's like over to one side, but like it seems like what is the boundary between them? It's like, oh yeah, they meet up here, and I'm like, well, if Space Town is if the city has got, you know, 20 million people in the city, or however much they say.
Yeah.
If the city has 20 million people in it, like a spaceport on the edge, like how big is that? And it always seems that it's a very small place. You know, you can just go over there and there's like a few courtyards or whatever. Exactly.
And they do live in the open air,
apparently. But you go, but also the buildings are connected, but they can see outside.
Yeah
it's not entirely clear. Like the vibe is clear, like the idea is clear, but a bit of the geography is a bit weird.
It's a little vague.
And they're like, oh, even when a crowd was rioting and wanting to get into the spaceport, there was actually, they could have just gone out of a gate, like the humans could have just gone out of a gate of the city, gone across land, and then gone in through a gate, like an unguarded gate of the spaceport, just because they could. And I'm like, has nobody ever heard of fences? A fence? Just a fence? Like, sure, humans don't want to go outside, but a fence would be handy. You know, it's a weird one.
It's a little bit, especially if there are riots. If people really want to riot, they will just go outside, right?
Yeah, and that's what this book is about. It's like, oh no, people don't just break down shops and loot and riot and kill people and, you know, and smash robots or something. But the whole point is, yes, they do. I mean, when you get a group of them, they will break social norms, you know.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things where you just go, yeah, like people get hungry after a disaster or there's a breakdown in society. Yes, people will break those rules, you know.
Yeah.
That's why societal norms exist. You know, there should be a pressure of shame against these kind of things. But when there's suddenly no shame attached to it anymore, it just clicks and then everyone does
people
it.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or they get out of the way of people who do it, you know.
One thing I wanted to mention is that I read this book last in, when was it, 2012, I think?
Yeah.
And you were saying, yeah, you read it several times and you remembered who was the murderer and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I did read three stories within this one book, I noticed that these three stories kind of mashed up together in my brain.
Oh, right.
So I was always thinking, there was this woman. And doesn't he go to meet the woman? Wasn't that woman the wife of the person that got murdered?
Yeah. I was mixing up all of those stories.
Yeah. So that's the Robbers of Dawn, is it?
No, there's the let's have a look. Caves of Steel. I'm sure it'll just have it here. Caves of Steel. Well, let's have a look at robots on the robot series over on Goodreads. What's the next one? Caves of Steel, Naked Sun, and then Robots of Dawn.
Yeah, Naked Sun. It was probably these three books I read in one go.
Yeah, and they got mixed up. So when you were reading this one, did you remember who was the...
I didn't know. So every time he was like coming up, I know who did it. I know the person.
Okay.
I always thought, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then it was always like, nah, that wasn't
it. No, that was not right. Yeah. So coming to the story is Elijah. There's a murder happens, just happens. We don't see it happening. It's just kind of reported. Like someone comes in and says, "Hey," like the commissioner comes in and says, "Elijah Bailey, you are an old friend of mine, a detective." Help me find out who killed this person, this spacer. Someone has killed a spacer, this robot building expert person over here. And here, the spacers have sent someone over, a detective over to work with you. And his name is R. Daniel, and it's a robot. He's going to be your partner on this one. It's a robot who looks very much like a human, can pass for human. And so the story is then Elijah Bailey, the detective, having to work with a robot who he doesn't really want to work with. He has to face his own prejudices about working with a robot because robots are not liked, especially because they're taking jobs of other people. That's R. Sammy is another robot in the who was replaced. Was it Vincent, I think the character's name is?
He was a young guy.
Vincent Barrett, a young man whose job was taken over by R. Sammy. Yeah, so robots coming and taking people's jobs is a big thing in this world. And so Elijah Bailey has to work with R. Daniel to like go, who has the motive to kill it and how did they get a gun and nobody had a gun? So who shot the person, whatever, you know? So it's, I don't want to get into any spoilers, but what happens, what I really like about this is you get like to that 50% of the book and he's like, right, I know who's done it. He starts laying it out and he's like, and it turns out he's wrong. And that, and he takes quite a few stabs at this problem before he finally solves it. Yeah. And that's what I always like about this book, that Asimov goes, well, the obvious thing would be this. And normally you don't want to just do the obvious thing. And normally detectives in these stories would go, well, that's the obvious thing. It can't be that. Or the reason why it's not this, they don't. Yeah. But he does this early, get everyone in the room, you know, all of the suspects in a room and talk them through and make the accusations like that.
It's kind of like Miss Marple kind of thing.
It is the perfect murder on the Orient Express kind of setup, or, you know, the butler did it, but to do this, you've got to do the reveal. And I love these scenes in movies where it's sort of like, why did you call us all here? It can't just be to eat dinner. It's like, no, it isn't to eat dinner. And then the detective over dinner goes around each person. It's like, could it have been you? Anyway, there's that moment that happens, but it's 50% the way through the book. So you're like, well, this can't be it. And it's like, no, it isn't.
But I really like it the way that he's like, every time he does this, he's very certain that he got all correct.
Yes.
And I really like the way that he thinks, because he does go from yeah, this is totally, I get it. Yeah, this could have been the way it was done.
Yeah, well, all
and
the,
I was always.
Yeah, all the evidence pointed that. Oh, you're breaking up a bit. All the other evidence pointed to his conclusion. It yeah. could have been right, but it didn't account for all of the facts. And that's what I always love about these things. It's like, yeah. it has to be the simplest explanation which accounts yeah. for all of the data. And yeah. it doesn't matter if there's nothing disproves it. It's that falsifiability kind of thing, isn't it? So you have to explain away the data and then also try and disprove your own case. That's why a law court can't just say, well, what's all the evidence against this person? And if there's enough evidence, you go, great, ticked. Like, there's like, but okay, but what evidence is not explained by this and what evidence is against it? You can't yeah. just have the evidence for column. You have to have the evidence against and evidence unexplained.
Yes, and there's this thing, it's called evidence, motive, opportunity.
Yes.
All these four, plus the negative of them,
yeah.
need to be there. And this is why I like this also, especially because it does have all those riddles and the
yeah.
mingling. And,
but that's the funny thing, is because I knew what the outcome was. And I also remember reading this before and having that feeling of like, hey, this reveal is coming a bit early. You know, so I remembered that yeah. kind of experience of reading it through. So I was picking out all the clues as I saw them coming up. And it's like, wow, it's all right here at the start.
yeah.
You know, and there's this very important line, again, talking around spoilers here, but there's a very important line halfway through. And it just goes by in passing. And I was like, well, that's the key to the entire story.
Yes.
He says, no, one of the characters just said, actually, no, stop. Don't conflate those two questions. You're actually asking two questions there. And Elijah Vail is just like, yeah, blah, 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 moves on with it. And I was like, yeah, that is the thing. So you're like, yes. It's so obvious. Of course, it isn't so obvious, but it's a good one.
It is not. But I like it the way that he states the three laws of robotics yeah. and then kind of explains how those things are still possible.
Yeah.
Even though you think like these three laws kind of make it so it's impossible for anything to happen with yeah. robot, right? And so I always like it that he states these three laws, which seem to be very filling all the holes that yeah. could make a robot do something bad towards a human. Mm. But then because in this story, he then finds those holes
yes.
that still makes it possible, yeah, well, which I find so clever.
Yeah, that's what I was saying before, that like, all of these stories, every single one of these stories yeah. is about one of the problems with the, and so I always find it funny when people say, well, of course, when someone says, oh, we should program robots with the three laws of robotics, and someone says, oh, no, it's not really realistic, they wouldn't really work, and people go, no, they would work, and I'm like, no, literally, this is what these books are for. These are all thought experiments about why you may think you can put in place simple laws like to do this, and of course it reflects on human nature and human laws as well. It's like, yes, of course you think you can just put in place a set of three simple rules, you know, like the golden rule, like don't do to other people, like, or do to other people how you would like them to do to you, or don't do to other people like yeah. you don't want them to do them to you, like, and you just go, well, that's yeah. it, that's the only law that we need. And it's like, turns out that's not the only law that we need, yeah. because you're like, do to other people if they, like you would like them to do to you, and it's sort of like, well, you know, I don't want to go to hell when I'm, you know, when I die, I don't want to go to hell. So what I should do is make sure nobody else does anything that I think would send them to hell. Yeah. So
yeah.
I better kill this abortion doctor then, because he's, you know, causing yeah. other women to sin. You're like, okay, that's a good idea. Okay, kill the abortion. You know, there's just so many different things. Yeah. And it's the whole point is that you can't just have three simple rules. And in this case, one of the things that is brought up is sort of like, well, if our Sammy encounters, or like, if, let me put this right, if a robot encounters another robot and can't tell if that robot is human or not, like, will the laws of robotics apply that? Like, would they stop? Would one robot exactly. stop another
would
robot
that,
coming from
heart? Would that robot yeah. think it is a human
yeah.
because robot is meant to look like a human?
So in that case, it's like, well, okay, so the three laws of robotics are don't harm a human, or through inaction let a harm come to a human, obey a human, and then protect yourself And of course, unless these ones counter the previous law. So yeah, you can destroy yourself to, you know, whatever like that. But then you're like, okay, but what are the laws about robot-robot interaction? Sort of like, is it, okay, don't, I mean, this is just me off the top of my head now. It's sort of like, okay, can a robot accidentally cause another robot to, like, can a robot interrupt another robot if that is the order of the person? So if you say, hey, robot, interrupt this other robot, you know, and what if the thing that the other person, the other robot was doing was something to stop harm coming somewhere? You know, it's like literally one order of interactions later and you're like, oh, well, it's already broken. And that's what all of these stories surround. It's sort of like, oh, yeah, it works on the face of it. But as soon as it comes up against real life, as soon as it comes up against one human motivation or intuition or anything at all, it all just falls down.
Also, I think it is interesting because the laws of robotics try to put something in law that within human society is kind of like, it is of course law as well. You are not allowed to murder a person. This is a law. But also humans have this inbuilt, you know, inhibition, is that the word? So that they naturally don't want to kill another person. In like generally speaking, but then you do have certain circumstances and certain things that make humans kill other humans.
Yes.
And this is kind of these laws are trying to put in place something that humans have built in naturally anyway, but are still broken as well.
It's the whole trolley problem. It even says in this book, sort of like, you can't harm a human. It's like, no, of course I can't. And then like this throwaway line is like, unless, of course, there's like two more, like there are two or more people over here, which I can save. And then, maybe I will harm someone. And you're just like, whoa. And it's just like skipped over. And like,
but you don't know until you're not in that situation how you would behave.
Yes.
So in this context, I just saw this video on Facebook, which showed a demonstration of, I didn't look into it. I didn't want to look further. But it showed a demonstration of a little weapons drone. Really small, fit in the palm of a hand, and it has, that person stated it has an inbuilt AI in it, so it's not piloted by a human. And then he started the saying by, isn't it good that we now can differentiate between the good guys and the bad guys?
Oh,
and already this is like, who are the bad guys and who are the good guys? It's always in the, you know, it's never just black and white.
No.
And if you then have this drone, it's just like, okay, yeah, sure, that drone doesn't behave like a human. It doesn't disobey orders, but a human does. Mm. And a human does, and that can save lives. And a drone just doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, it's like, who is in the loop? But I read this amazing article recently by Ted Chiang. You know, you just mentioned him on the Reading Envy Best of the Year because you read the short story collection, The Stories of Your Life. Or it wasn't that collection, but, you know, like a collection there. Yeah, and so he's just written this article, which is sort of like a state of the world, kind of like, what are we looking at the moment? And it's an incredible article because he says these tech people are saying, oh, we should really look out for artificial intelligence in the future because, you know, it's this system which doesn't have human controls on it or, you know, whatever's going on. And we can't let them take over because they're not in control. They don't have any...
they don't have compassion.
Yeah, well, it's not compassion, but empathy. It's sort of the reflection, or I can't remember the word that you used, but it's sort of like when you... you think and then you think about thinking, or you do something and you think about why, you know, that reflection kind of idea. And he says, well, we already have that in society, and it's corporations. Corporations exist and they think, but they don't think about thinking. There is no reflecting on their motivations. And I thought that was really interesting, sort of like, oh, all of the problems that we think are going to happen with robots in the future or could happen with AI in the future are already here. They are already happening, and they are corporations and they are other systems of that are in place which aren't reflective, which aren't. And it's a really interesting way of looking. I can't remember how I got onto that, but it's just one of those things about like, oh, AI is, you know, it's okay. We know who the good guys are. We know who the bad guys are now. AI can sort that out. And you're like, really? Really can it? But you understand that the people saying this or the things that are causing these things to exist are already exhibiting the problems that AI would have, like corporations being an entity. So like, oh yeah, corporations can have free speech because they are, you know, they are treated in law in America as people, you know. And it's like, yeah, but they're people, and if they break the law, they don't get thrown in jail because it's a corporation. No. Or it's a corporation, but if they're that greedy, nobody says, oh, you stop being so greedy, because greed is just built into them. And so there could, like, if you think about it, there could be this thing sort of like the three laws of robotics could be applied to the corporations. But of course it doesn't, because there's only one law to these corporations, which is, you know, provide value to shareholders or something. And everything else gets subsumed into that. It's sort of like, well, I guess we should follow some laws, maybe? It's like, but If it's in our best interest,
if you look at it that way, it's like the most egoistic thinking entity. You know, they are thinking about their own good. Hello, you still there?
I'm still here. Yeah.
Okay, so they are only thinking about how they are sustaining, how they growing.
Yeah.
And they don't, as I said before, they don't have compassion, they don't have empathy, because it is only about their own goal.
Yeah,
right?
But my point is, the point of the article is that even if individuals within a corporation do have empathy and compassion, have good goals as well, you know, like Elon Musk, it's one of those things that Elon Musk, like, oh yeah, we've got to save the world, so we've got to have batteries and electric cars, and we've got to get to space. So it doesn't matter about the noble goals. The mindset, the corporation and capitalistic mindset of the people exhibits all of the problems that Elon Musk himself says we've got to look out for these in AI. It's sort of like, well, look at yourself. It's that lack of reflection that's the thing. All right.
And it is quite interesting, because we recently just, you know, we're talking more about robots and having a household and stuff.
Yeah.
I did listen to or not podcast, and you know that.
Wait a second, you're breaking up,
you're breaking up quite a bit.
Stop a second. You're breaking up a bit.
Oh, sorry.
Go back. Okay. So there's a podcast called Robot or Not.
Yes.
On the Incomparable Network. So talk about that then. Let's go.
You made me listen to it a few times. Like I listened to
episodes.
A few of them.
Yeah. The episode's like 2 minutes long, and it gets good. Episode two is where you should start.
And so it was to think more about what is actually a robot. Is a dishwasher a robot or not?
Yeah.
And this kind of stuff. So it is interesting for me to listen to. But I have such a problem to get past the incoming jingle or whatever they play at the beginning. It kills me.
The robot or not jingle.
Awful.
Yeah. Because it's the whole point is that it sounds like a robot singing, like a robot doesn't understand music. It sounds like, what if a robot writes a jingle? It doesn't understand melody. That's the whole point of that. That's what I really like about it.
Oh, I hate it.
The later episodes, other people have versions of it, and they have like, there's sort of like 12 different robot or not themes. Of course, they're all like 5 seconds long, so it gets through.
Yeah. As long as they are not like two voices kind of. Just singing next to each other, but just not getting it. Just like next to the it hurts my ears so much. Anyway, so that's quite a funny thing to listen to.
Yeah.
To figure out is it a robot or not?
Yes.
Because we do have our little Art O'Neill at home, right?
Yes, we have a little what's it called? E-bots, whatever. Anyway, it's a. The idea
it's
being
a vacuum Hoover thing.
Yeah, a vacuum cleaner, little Roomba kind of thing. And yes, there's an app where you can control it and do it. And you can name the app. No, you can name the robot
in
the app.
You can name the robot.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
once you give it a name, does it make a difference? Once you know that Art O'Neill, like once you know that this guy who is a robot that looks like a human does have a name.
Yeah.
Does it make it different? Does it make it?
I don't know,
you know,
but do we treat our little robot at home? We actually call the little robot our Daniel, after the robot in these robot books. But do you think of our little floor sweeping robot differently now that it's got a name?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm thinking about it as a human, obviously not. But it does have more of a not a character, but it does more have like a personal feel, because it is individual and. Entity, and it does go around and of course I give it the order to do something, but it does it by itself, you know. I mean, it does go around and clean the floor, you know? So it's, for me, it feels a lot different than a kettle or a dishwasher or washing machine, because it does move around, you know?
Yeah. Self-directed movement, to accomplish a task. Yes, that is one of those things. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Like, again, there is a robot, there's a whole podcast called Robot or Not, which, it's good. There's 100 episodes listing, like, is this a robot? Yes or no. Is this a robot? Yes or no. And I agree with about 90% of John Syracuse's declarations. But there are a few things where I'm like, not quite there. Although his logic is good, but some of his first principles I don't get. Like,
sure.
I'm not entirely convinced with. Right, shall we look through some of the notes? I made some notes here in the book.
Okay, well, my only notes were the notes about the laws of robotics.
Oh, okay.
I put out again to have them there. That's basically all the notes that I have.
Yeah.
Except general feelings towards the book.
Well, we'll talk about them in a bit. Okay, so there's this, what was this thing that I made a note of here? It says he calls you the friendliest name he knows, you know, R. Sammy, the idiot police robot.
Task
robot. And he says a friendship circuit, no robot built of any type could possibly hurt a human being. So the notes that I made, which was like this idea of being a friendship circuit, but then other people are saying, oh, this, but they also talk about the human's loyalty quota. And I think it's funny that they kind of, there's an idea that robots have friendship programs built in, but humans have been kind of bred over the thousand years or few thousand years between now in our time and the time this book is set to have kind of like a high loyalty quota. And the people with a high loyalty quota are the ones who get the jobs in the police force and other things like that. So I always like the idea of like, okay, well, how do we reduce suffering in this way? The example I always like is with animal cruelty. You know, one thing that we could do is treat chickens better. The other thing we could do is breed them so they don't they have smaller and smaller brains, so they can't feel, they don't recognize suffering or can't feel pain anymore. And it's like, oh, there's two different ways to get to this thing. Like, we could create artificial meat as well. Let's do that. We can create a sack of cells which just sits there and doesn't do anything except it just, you know, just builds up muscle
like
mass, and then you just kill it. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of what we've done now with battery farming. We've like bred these chickens so they can't even stand up anymore. All they do is eat and shit. And then like after 20 days, they're big enough to kill and eat or whatever it is, you know, like that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And because the brain is a chicken, it can't feel. It's not like a cow, which has emotions and stuff. Yeah, just kill. So it's one of those things that like, oh, right, you can program things in, create things for real, or maybe thousands of years of social evolution and conditioning makes it that you can then just select out of the 20 million people in the city, just select the ones with the highest loyalty quota and the lowest, you know, there's these different quotas of humans. So I thought that was an interesting idea.
I also like the, you know, that the robot, he has this thing, cerebral analytics, you know, where he scans the brain. What was this called? Cerebral
something. Yeah, it's like scanning. Yeah. It's like a MRI scan. Not MRI. What is it?
My MRI.
It's not MRI. It's the one where the brain function one.
Yeah, it's an fMRI where you can see
functional.
What are the parts that are active now?
Yes, it's an fMRI.
And you can find, so I thought that I was quite funny because obviously, some of the humans didn't know it was done to them.
Well, that's the key point in the book, that at the start he's like, oh yeah, and I gave him a lie detector test, but it's like a lie detector test that he doesn't know has happened, which is
scanning his brain.
Yeah. some of the stuff between Lige Bailey and his wife gets a bit dark. And again, it's one of those things like, oh, this was written in the 1950s. How much of this is just sexism at the time? How much of it is this character himself like being portrayed as not a good person? And I think that's part of it as well. So it's this mix of like, oh, how much of this sexism is Isaac Asimov's at the time, and how much of it is him commenting on like the kind of person who would do that
character.
And And for me, the way I look at it, it's like, it's a bit about 50-50. There are a few things which seem to be written into all women and all men, and some things which are specific of some characters. Which is strange. Some of the writing, I think, is like, it gets very clunky at some points. For example, there's this, his wife is saying, Jezebel or Jessie is saying, she's actually within a conversation, within sort of her dialogue. I used to ask her how she was so sure that was so, especially after you and I met Lige. Remember the talks we used to have. And then she would quote, but the talks we used to have is in brackets. And I always find it weird when you read dialogue and someone is saying something and then they say something in parentheses. And, yes. And I'm like, but parentheses are written. Are they spoken? Wouldn't it be like, you know, couldn't it be like, and she said, whimsically, or, you know, I don't know, it's one of those things that, you know, that could just be written into the sentences with normal punctuations. Parentheses within spoken dialogue, I think, is one of those things which I'm like, that seemed to be, I don't know, how do they have that in there? Like, is she saying that, or is she thinking that? I'm not really sure.
But then I'm never sure. Sometimes publishers do change this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, that would be...
It's a little bit always like in sheet music, you always have to differentiate between what the composer actually wrote and what the publisher added for ease of reading, you know? Yeah. And this could be certainly something that the publisher's just adapted to their style or whatever. So that could be possible.
I mean, that's a minor point, very specific, but there are some other things. I do have some other complaints about some of the writing, which is sort of like, suddenly this person is an expert on the Bible. It's like, you know, Isaac Asimov wrote like 20 books about the Bible and then 40 history books or whatever it is. Like,
convenient.
Yeah, it's like very convenient that this one person just happens to know the story. And even, I mean, this is set thousands of years in the future, but even from 1954 to today, what's that, like 60 years later or whatever, 60 years later, if you said the word Jezebel to somebody, most people, I reckon that these days, most people wouldn't pick up on that as being a biblical reference.
Bible reference, yeah.
I mean, there is.
I thought the same.
There is still the connotation that Jezebel is a witch or Jezebel is the evil woman that, you know, like, so that still survives, but that people would be able to just go, oh yeah, but you know that story in the Bible, and then just talk about the story in the Bible. And at one point he's like, oh, now let me just quote part of the Bible. And it is a famous passage, you know, sort of like, it's a famous parable. So it's okay to be, people would be able to retell that parable. But even now, who knows the parables of Jesus in that way that they could just start quoting them, or like, oh, Jehoshaphat. And I'm like, who?
this is what they used to swear, right?
I think only Elijah Bailey does that. But yeah, it is one of those weird things that you go, oh, there's a bit of Shakespeare quoting. But then at some points, like, you just go, if this is that important for everyone, but then the robot is sort of like, you know about Jesus? And he's like, who? You know the Bible? What? Yeah. And I'm like, you were sent into
like
the world.
The robot.
Yeah.
Yeah, the robot is kind of like the modern human.
Yeah. that is true in a way. But yeah, everyone's got biblical names. All these people have got bits like Elijah Bailey and Daniel. Yeah. Like Daniel is sort of, well, kind of Daniel and Jezebel.
Samuel. I mean, our Sammy.
Yeah,
no?
Samuel. Sammy? Yeah, it's all very big. And of course, the son was his Bentley or Ben or something like
Bentley,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bentley Bailey, and they're like, that's a funny name.
Is it also a biblical name, Bentley?
No, it's specifically not. It's specifically not. That's what they said. This is not a biblical name. She says, I don't want a biblical name. Yeah. Any name which is the commissioner is called Julius. That's a bit of like Caesar, pay unto Caesar. You know, it's all of these different things were in there. Not all of the names are biblical names, but it does feel a bit weird that, like, oh, so in 1,000 years time, people are still going to be quoting the Bible and knowing the Bible and knowing the characters from the Bible, and it's going to be like a defining part of their personality that they have this name from the Bible. And already that doesn't make my name. I have biblical, like, all my family have biblical names. There's Nathan and Leah and Bethany and Luke, you know, all biblical names. But Luke isn't a biblical name anymore. Luke is now a Star Wars name. You know, when I was growing up, nobody was like, oh, I mean, there was a few times if I was hanging out with someone called Mark and Matthew and I'm Luke and we're like, oh, we just need a John. Once we get a John, we'll complete the set. But that's like saying John and Paul and what comes after John and Paul now? That's the thing.
No idea.
Oh, so it's not going to be... What?
No, nothing.
Ringo or something. The point is that, like, different names, John and Paul, is more Beatles now than it is Apostles or something like that. It's the Apostle Paul. Sure. It's John the, you know, John the Baptist or whatever. But then it's not like, no, it's... they're the Beatles, you know.
Apostles have changed to... It's kind of like you have modern... collection of names of people who are more important than something.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Even the Beatles said, oh, we're bigger than Jesus or whatever the quote was, you know.
Yeah. And I'm sure, like, if you write a book thousands of years from now, you need to invent some new kind of pop culture kind of thing.
Well,
they then reference. So, you know.
Well, that's the thing that really annoyed me about this book that I read last year, I think it was now, so probably a year and a half ago, which was called We Are Legion, We Are Bob. And again, a biblical reference right there in the title. And and it's a book, it's like a Ready Player One kind of book where the main character is a nerd who knows all the references and stuff. And he goes hundreds of years into the future. And then all of his references and all of his fandom is about...
Handy to have to know.
Well, no, the whole point is that he comes out 100 years, 200 years in the future and is the biggest Star Trek fan and the biggest Star Wars fan and the biggest fan of this and the biggest fan of that. But then he exhibits literally zero curiosity about what has happened in Star Trek after, like... 2014 or whenever the book was.
So it feels like it was just, it's like everything went up to now
and then stops
but
I think it's because the author of the book doesn't want to upset people when he would say but you could have said this easily with Star Wars, like, oh yeah, up until 1999 Star Wars, and then the brave author of a book which was written in 1998 would say, oh, and then there was another trilogy of movies came out, and they were so bad that they became some of the worst reviled movies, and it spoiled people's stuff like that. Like a good author would write that, and everyone would go, no, not Star Wars. No, it can't be. Yeah. No, it can't be not Star Wars. It's not Star Trek. It's not like every other movie is bad like Star Trek. No, these are good movies. But in this book, it was sort of like, yeah, and then I woke up, and I was thinking, go back and read all the books and see all the movies and see all the TV shows that you've missed in that time, that when you died in 2014, like Star Trek Discovery's come out, like loads more Star Wars movies. But no, the author of the book was so incurious about it that he just wasn't willing to invent new popular culture.
And that is always this is kind of what makes good authors or amazing authors amazing, is that they not only invent a story...
They invent the stories for the people in the book, yeah. Exactly. I mean, that's what Yoon Ha-Lee did as well in Nine Books Gambit. She's like, oh yeah, and I go and watch my soap operas and stuff. And it's like, yes, it's soap operas, but it wasn't just soap operas, it was like a new form of like story, like that it only exists in their future, that kind of TV show or whatever it is, so with the characters. Anyway, I think that's it. Of this book, let's give some ratings here because I do need to go and get a taxi in 15 minutes. I need to get a taxi to the airport.
Okay, do it. Well, my rating doesn't change since I last read it.
Yeah.
So leave 5 stars for me.
5 stars.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sure. Okay. I didn't realize this was a 5-star kind of book for you. Not for me, I don't think, but it is still highly rated. I would still call this a 4-star book because even though I've read it a few times before and this reading, it is one of those books which is short enough that I can reread it and not have to worry too much about knowing what happens or like, you know, I can get some out of it again.
Yeah. Maybe not a 5. No. Maybe 4.5, but for good reasons, it's 5.
Yeah, it's 5-star. You go with 5 stars if you want. I'm going to go with 4 stars. Let's call it a 4.5 star. But also, it is one of those books which is so... I do think it's a science fiction classic, and it is one of Isaac Asimov's best books. And I think it's one of his best books for a reason, or one of his most famous books for a reason, because it is a really great, a really good, fun, if flawed, detective novel, plus a really interesting...
experimental,
like society, like dystopian kind of thing, and a really good exploration of the robot kind of stuff. Yes. You know, so if you want like a good introduction to the robot stories by Isaac Asimov, this isn't a bad place to start, because there is a lot of humanity in there as well, and it does follow along. Of course, the short stories are good, but you know, you're not that interested in a quirky short story. This is a good place to start. So,
yeah, I think so too.
And this links up with this other series as well. It kind of, when I was reading this, I was like, oh yeah, maybe it isn't completely weird that he linked up this series to his Foundation series. It kind of, this one kind of lays the groundwork of like linking those series together. But have you ever read Foundation? I'm not sure.
No, I didn't. No, I haven't yet.
Well, maybe we'll get to that at some point. Like this book, this was written as a serial as a serial published in Galaxy Magazine, December 1953, And then in 1954, it was made, combined into a hardcover book. That's what a lot of these old stories are, these fix-up things. But this is a very good story, all links together. It's like, yes, this was definitely written as a single story, unlike the Foundation books, where it's sort of like, yes, we've got four short novellas here, or four short stories, or five short stories or something. We'll combine them together. We'll call that a novel. It's much more of a single story than a lot of his
Do you think this should be made into a movie?
This book? The problem is Will Smith came along and made iRobot and kind of soured me on Isaac Asimov movies, because they can't help but break the laws of robot. It's not an exploration of how the laws of robotics are broken. It always becomes, let's just break the laws of robotics. And it's like, that's not the point. To be honest, it wouldn't be that bad of a movie if it was just sort of like, oh, this is just a movie and we're just going to like reference the laws of robotics. But because it's called iRobot, it's sort of like every movie that comes out now will be mostly compared to that Will Smith movie. And that's another one which they messes up in that book. In the start of that movie, he puts on like a CD player, and then he's like, I'm gonna put on my trainers. It's like, yeah, vintage 2002 trainers. And I sort of like look at my watch and I was like, what's the date today? Oh yeah, it's 2002. That CD player you can buy in the shops now, those trainers you can buy right now. And it's like, oh, that's so awful. Like, the product placement made it so someone who was interested in the past was interested in our exact past right now, exactly as this book. But I do like it, actually. One more thing about this book that I like is, when they're talking about the current day, they call it the Middle Ages. So like, we are medieval.
All medieval stuff.
Well, it says back in the medieval times, and it's like, we are kind of medieval. But of course, I think the joke is on them, because we look at their society, they're kind of almost post-apocalyptic, but you know, like Malthusian caution case of 8 billion people all living inside and being afraid to go outside, and we're the medieval ones. And say again,
they're smelly.
It's all like, oh, turns out put 20 million people with no air movement, oh, it gets a bit stinky.
As mentioned
a few times, is the smell of the city. All right, that's it. We've done 50 minutes on that, and I was hoping to do about 30 minutes, but going here as well. It says, more recently, Akiva Goldsman has been hired to produce a movie. He was a screenwriter. Batman Forever, Batman and Robin, but I Am Legend and Cinderella Man. So he has worked on 1950s with I Am Legend. It's kind of a bit that's sort of like a 1950s book in this style, where you go, oh, it's a classic of science fiction / fantasy / horror, whatever. And
we'll see.
Not too good. And yes, he's also a beautiful mind. He got the Academy Award for that. Yeah. So who knows? Maybe Akiva J. Goldsman will do a good job with this. Who knows?
Sure.
Oh,
all right.
My problem.
Let's wrap up.
2004. He wrote iRobot. Boo. Okay. So that's what I'm saying. If it's made into a movie, I didn't want anyone who wrote iRobot to have anything to do with it. And unfortunately, Wikipedia tells me that the person has been hired to produce the movie is the person who also did iRobot. Okay. So that's it. Thanks a lot for listening. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge. Juliana is on Twitter. She is JUKU Berlin. UKU Berlin. It kind of stands for a name. And you can follow me on Instagram. I'm Luke Burge there. And on YouTube, I'm Luke Burge there. And in the new year, we'll talk more about YouTube. And what else do I say? Oh, yeah, check out sfbrp.com. And you can see every episode that we've done. All the books listed in order. There's the archive feed there if you want to go back and listen to starting on episode number one. It is the 21st of December. This will be our last, probably our last joint podcast before the new year.
Yeah, that's right.
So happy new year, Juliana.
Happy new year, happy Christmas.
Yes, everything like that. Although I do have some other podcasts to record, which will probably be going up in a few days, but I'm going to Antarctica twice.
Woo-hoo.
That's going to be my next time. Yes, and also go over to Goodreads and we can see what you think about this book. For example, this book, Friends Reviews, is a 3.97 rating. Michael rated it 5 stars. Julie Davis, 5 stars. Stephen rated it 4 stars. Hollow Man, 4 stars. Yes, so this seems to be a quite highly rated. Paul rated it 3 stars. Dated, but worth a read if you like classic science fiction. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
cool. Juliana Kunzendorf rated it 5 stars. Right, that's it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.